Welcome once again to Lesbian Nation. First thing we're going to do is turn you over to Mary Flowerpot, and after that, we're going to have an interview with Bertha Harris of Richmond College, who's going to teach us how to write novels.
Yes, well, hello everybody. This is Mary Flowerpot again, bringing to you a few of those little insights into what's really been happening out there. Are you nicely stoned and sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. First, I have to tell you that this show has been undergoing some changes since we started 6 or 7 episodes ago. We've been shedding engineers faster than snakes get rid of their skins, and for those of you who are regular listeners, you will already have been in at the demise of one who, amid a sound effect entitled Medium War, had to lay down and die, and then rush off to engineer some news bulletins, never to be seen again. Two others have suffered similar fates. And I'll tell you why. This is because this programme is technically difficult to produce, and it's as much of the engineer's handiwork as mine. But anyway, time's at a premium here, but we seem to have got the problem licked, for at the last minute we have found a woman who was also an engineer. So now we have Nancy Ellen sitting behind the board tonight, and things will be taking a different turn. Yes, away with all those guns and bombs. Didn't do those men any good, did they? So we're going to get into something pleasant and gentle tonight. For instance, we might do a flary Mowerpot stary for it. A story Lowerpot fairy mori. Oh, God, I ought to straighten my head. Mary Flowerpot fairy story. Yes. Yes, there are fairies at the bottom of my flower pot. They're called Chiba Chiba, Topcut, and Acapulco. Worth more greenbacks than I can mention. I'll just put one in my cash register and you'll see what I mean.
Into this war, the United States never for a moment thought that she was intervening in the politics of Europe or the politics of Asia or the politics of any part of the world.
Well, I think that's made the point. Now, how about a dip into the old post bag before we pursue the fairies further? A few interesting things have come up, I can tell you. Let's see. Some letters here. Pro and con. I shall call the pro gnomes and con trolls. Well, never mind about the cons. Trolls are so disagreeable. Here's a pro gnome I really dig. It's signed God Bless You, Gran, and reads, Dear Ms. Flowerpot, I am 81 and can't write good, but I want you to know I love you and your beautiful flower show. As I live alone, you know, except for my lovely cats, I look forward to your programme, and it is one of the few things my fading mind understands. I wish your show was on every night. Well, that's nice, isn't it? Good old Gran. I'm awarding you, Gran, the millionth happy listener medal. Actually, I only know about 6 others, listeners, that is, but I'm eagerly awaiting to hear from the rest. Let's see, that'll be 250,306 noughts in a million. I don't know, is that an American million or a British? Well, anyway, take away 6 leaves 999,994. Think, yes. Well, when you get to that, Gran, you'll know you're knocking on. Meanwhile, look out in the mail for a plastic replica of a gold-plated medal taken from the tomb of Tutankhamun, specially for you. Custom-packed, custom-sized, a perfect fit, gift-wrapped and ready for Christmas, to give straight to your old Aunt Nell. Only 84 shopping days left, you know. Well, anyway, who's next? Ah, here's a very pro-gnome here, writing on green paper with a flowery-lined envelope to match. She signs herself Love Ellen Gustafson. She says how much she likes the program. Maybe because I'm not politically orientated, as everybody gets so serious they forget to laugh. She also asks if I would comment on the book The First Sex by Elizabeth Gould Davis. Yes, well, for a start, I think that book got the wrong title. I mean, to have really got off the ground, it should have been called The Sex First, and we'll talk about everything you didn't know afterwards. Yes, well, let's have some fairy music then. What's that? Oh, I can't do this. Oh, I know. Oh, well, I've just been told that we can't get into this fairy story after all, as a few hobgoblins have messed the works up. Never mind. Let's see. I'll read you an extract from my porno newspaper. That'll be a nice treat. Rosemary stretched out her hand, putting it to Gloria's breast, just between her enormously jutting... She could feel the flesh lifting with each beat that her heart gave. She took a deep breath just before her lashes masked her dilated pupils and went for the last couple of inches that separated her from her. Coming closer and closer, she felt the beginning of the heat from her quivering body as it struck her face in increasing waves of... Don't think I can keep this turned on, folks. The temperature has gone up in here enough to knock the instrument sideways. Let's see now. I'll just put on this record here, which is actually in two halves. I found it in a garbage can on my way to the studio. So let's see what's on it. I'll just put the middle on. Do you see what that is? That's actually the first record to be played backwards. It's Aida. It's Aida playing backwards. Well, that'll be a museum piece for BAI. Anyway, I'd better either just fade out into the crack of this record or leave you with the real Aida. Perhaps I'd better. So here's the real Aida, the trumpet solo. Anyway, she had troubles of her own. So listen to her.
This is an interview with Bertha Harris, who teaches out at Richmond College. What are you teaching out there?
I'm the full-time person in women's studies. and although my background's in literature, things I'm not really teaching anything. I'm learning a great deal, but ostensibly what I'm teaching is a course on classism as it relates mainly to women, or almost entirely to women, and a writing workshop for women.
And you've written a couple of novels, right?
Yeah. Two novels. The first one is Catching Sarah Dove, and the second one is Confessions of Carabino, both of which are, I hope, somewhat relevant to women's experience.
I understand they're both lesbian novels or deal with a lesbian experience, or is that just a mistaken impression? I haven't read them yet, much to my dismay.
Much to my dismay, too, Martha.
Well, you're going to lend me a couple of copies before I leave.
Yeah, they deal with the lesbian experience because that is my life. And the first one is, of course, autobiographical, which is, you know, in the traditional sense, your first novel is supposed to be autobiographical. And it's a working out of my experience with my parents and becoming a lesbian. It's, in a sense, what you might call an old gay head working out there, because it comes from, the book comes from the time, pre-movement times, when if you were a homosexual, you were old gay in that sense. And it deals with the absolute ruinous experience that being old gay was. The bar scene, living all night from woman to woman, living all night in this kind of highly frenetic, tense, in many ways artificial, highly emotional, in many ways bizarre atmosphere. And finally getting exhausted till I decided that straight people were right, you know, that it was a sickness and it was very bad for people to live this way. And since I could find no alternative back in those days in the 50s and 60s, I found a man in the peace movement and got married for a short while and had a daughter. That's what the book is basically about.
I was wondering how you got into writing novels, how you started, because frankly I'm having difficulty getting started. I have dreams about sitting in front of paper and nothing comes out. Literal dreams.
Write your dreams down.
Well, is that what you started to do or what? I mean, how did you get into it? I'm just curious about your experience, really, rather than advice to a budding author.
Well, I've been writing, say, since I was about 10 years old, and it came from living probably in a very isolated childhood with nothing but a mother and a father who were very withdrawn into themselves, having very few friends. We were extremely poor, and it comes from a time, too, when there were very few things that children could do. And in my community in the South, no concessions were made to children, to children's needs. You came from a certain economic class. You could, your family belonged to the country club, and therefore you'd go swimming and have a lot of friends and so forth. But if you came from the working class, as I did, then you were cut off. And since we had no street corners, no, you didn't have the candy store around the corner where you could hang out and that sort of thing. At least women didn't. The boys, as soon as they were 16, could get a license and run around town. It was like a small town in which there was a great deal of class stratification. The rich people did one thing and the poor people did another. Your life, if you were poor, was centered around going, as a child, centered around going to school, going home, and if you could rip up movie fare, you could go to the movies. But that was about the size of it. I was even more isolated because my father was sort of the town drunk. We were mostly Irish Catholic. There was great shame attached to this. Even in the schools, the class stratification was very heavy. And so I sort of found myself eventually living in a world of fantasy, and one day I discovered the public library and read my way through the library and began writing it down about the age of 10. And so I guess from the age of about 10 to 14, I wrote a book that, I don't know, probably would, if printed, would go into the thousands of pages. It, I think it was called The Autobiography of Alice Primrose. And it was a huge fantasy trip in which our brilliant young heroine is kidnapped from her parents' English country estate, and she gets lost in London, and she goes, and she's on Arab caravans and lost in the jungles, and fights off pirates and rescues other people and so forth and so on. And the book never really did end, but that was my sort of escape thing, and it developed the habit of writing as a way to survive, really, and that's what it's continued for me to be, is it's a reason to live that supersedes just about everything else, really.
My story at this point would be somewhat different. Little Red Robin Hood, with her sister Red Rose, or Rose Red, or whatever, runs off and joins the Seven Dykes.
Yeah.
And blows up a building and gets arrested and takes over the Pentagon eventually, and all sorts of lovely little fantasies like that.
Well, you come from a city left background. Your family was left oriented, they weren't?
No. My family was sort of FDR Democrats. Oh. But you know, I got into the left after leaving home and dropping out of graduate school.
That's a good idea.
What, dropping out of graduate school?
Yeah. And I think that the habit of writing fiction, which is about the only thing I really know how to do, comes from the absolute necessity for to see chaos, the chaos of reality, transformed into something beautiful or something realer than reality, you know. And I think that fiction at its best makes reality real. It makes experience happen again and again and again and again. And in a way that philosophy cannot do it, in a way that sociological, psychological, and so forth, writing cannot do it, you know. I can still read, Swan's Way, and although I've never lived as a, you know, French princess or something like that, I feel that French princess.
Yeah, I suppose after having read One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, I can feel what it's like to be cold and hungry all the time, though I haven't been. You know, just reading that book, you get cold around the edges.
Yeah, and what, you know, the popular sort of movement novel now, The Bell Jar, that a woman can read that who was not an intellectual star, but she can identify with the Sylvia Plath's pain as a woman. And in her extremity, see some of her own problems in Plath's extremities. Now, maybe that's what fiction is it presents extremities of feeling and being and living, and a person who even doesn't live to those extremes knows at least partially what that experience is and can make some richness out of her own life.
Well, I was thinking of photography too, in a different vein. I mean, you can see pictures of a fire escape, photographs that suddenly make a thing of beauty out of that awful fire escape that has to be stuck on the front of your building.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Fiction is, the words now are becoming impossible to use. Like, what is a poem? What is a novel? What is a philosophical diatribe? You know, it's not, verse in Colette's. It's writing that is supposedly prose, but it's nearer a poem in many cases. Nightwood, you know, the great lesbian novel or homosexual novel, is nearer, I think, a poetic rendition of the pain of the homosexual experience rather than what we normally think of as a novel with plot, action, conclusions, and that sort of thing.
You know, I was just thinking that if I wrote stuff, I've been thinking about writing about the experience I had working on Rat Newspaper. And I haven't been able to. When I sit down and I tried to talk it into this tape recorder, and all that came out was a whole bunch of political analysis and intellectualization. But when I think about it, when I just remember it, I can
taste how gritty it was that spring and how terrible it was on the Lower East Side. And how the whole Lower East Side was like this open, steaming garbage pit. And how we ran around in this awful little office trying to put a newspaper together, and the police, you know, sitting across the street in a car, 24-hour surveillance of us. You know, I can remember it, I can taste it almost, but I really get blocked at putting it down. And I think that if I could put it down, I could convey it to other people, just how it was. You know, just describing it, people could feel what it was like in those days, in those bad old days when everybody thought the revolution was around the corner.
Well, it is, of course, isn't it?
No.
The light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, the light at the end of... What it could be, of course, is that you're still too close to the experience. I know that I had to go back... I wrote most of my first novel while I'm still in New York. I wrote it all, the first draft. But I wrote it all here, the whole thing. But, like, my life on the Lower East Side when I had the little kid and was living in the steaming garbage and with the muggers and the guys nodding out on the front steps and so forth and Coke bottles flying through the windows. Well, I was going to say that, you know, you have to get away from the experience a little bit in order to transform it or get it written down, but I started writing that first book, which opens with the Lower East Side experience, while I was still living there. And I think it was a way of getting rid of the experience that it helped me get out by putting it down on paper. I think you're making a mistake maybe by using a tape recorder. You ought to force yourself to, you know, the sort of physical action of holding a pen in your hand and putting it on paper or a typewriter, you know, seeing the word as it comes out would probably break it. Choosing who you're going to center in on, yourself or...
Do you usually start off, writing... like the first page of a book, or do you sit down, figure out who your characters are, what?
No, and I've learned that this is what blocks, I work only with women now. I found that they have there's a popular misconception about getting a book together, and that is you are supposed to know the beginning and the middle and the end and what's going to happen and so forth before you even write the first sentence. And I don't believe that any good writing is really like that, unless, of course, it is, well, let's say any good fiction or verse, literature, if you know, I can use that much abused term, is like that. I think of writing a novel the way a tree grows, you know, it's an organic process. If you write one sentence, you start with one sentence, if you know what you're going to say in that one sentence, and it's real, and you let the next sentence grow out of that sentence, and you don't ever think ahead. I told a student the other day that I never know what's going to happen in the next paragraph, much less the next chapter, much less the end of the book, because in a way that's manipulating your characters, and it's manipulating your own feeling. You get in control of the language, but that's all you're in control of, and then you write one true sentence, and then the next sentence comes, and then the next sentence comes, and soon you have a paragraph, and soon, you know, somebody you're writing about does something that you didn't know she was going to do, but suddenly she does it, you know. It's staying in touch with your own feelings and head. And the ends of my books, for instance, are always a surprise to me.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's an adventure. It's uncharted territory, you know. It takes the burden off writing, too, because you really don't know what's going to happen. The only thing you really have to stay in control of is the language, you know. And you can, you know, we all know that you have control of that, you know.
Yeah, I have control over the language here, and I can bleep it if I want to.
Yeah.
Wow, I gotta play this tape for my lover. What about poetry? Do you ever write that?
Well, during the autobiography of Alice Primrose, which I named her Alice Primrose because Primrose was the name of a woman I was in love with. Her name was Primrose McPherson Pascal, and she was an art teacher in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I thought she was the most beautiful, glamorous, exciting, intellectual, creative goddess I'd ever met in my life, and so Primrose became, with her poor, ridiculous name, became the name of this, but I...
Well, you know about the Primrose Path.
Yeah, right. Unfortunately, my Primrose Path did not lead anywhere. But I started writing poetry because I fell in love, right, at the age of 13 or something. I fell in love with Primrose, and so I had to write poetry. In the classic tradition, you write poetry because you're in love, and this awful, ghastly stuff, surging with emotion and pain, and I don't think I ever had any real gift for it, but I went to what was then the Woman's College of the University of North Carolina, which was basically a school that was designed for young women who could not afford to go anyplace else. It was a state school for women, and it originated to train them to be teachers, of course. And the way that women got to go there, of course, was whether the crop came in that year or, you know, the mill stayed running. It was a very exciting school, and the women there were very intense and learning and desperate for learning in a way that I haven't seen anywhere I've ever taught. A large majority of the students were lesbians there.
Majority?
In the humanities and the arts, of course. Theater, music, English, you know, every other English major was a lesbian. A lot of them, of course, went downhill after college and got married and that sort of thing. You know, I'm sure they're still in grief over it. But my lover was kicked out of that school twice for her lesbian activity. They had very good teachers there, men for the most part, unfortunately, who taught there, although they made very little money, but they came there because they were very interested in the education of women and were willing to make financial and geographical sacrifices in order to work with what was the large part, first-generation college women, because they really turned on. We still thought in those days of education being the great liberator and the great entry into the world, and we didn't even think of it in terms of professionalism. It was very exciting to be there. But there was a teacher there, who was a very famous poet named Randall Jarrell, who had also chosen to work with these women. And I wrote poetry for him because he was a poet. And for a few years after college, I wrote poetry, but decided that I wasn't good enough.
It's funny. I guess I'm a first generation college person. My mother was an immigrant. My father was a mechanic until he graduated into being a clerk. Maybe it's because of that. Maybe it's something else. But now I'm getting all excited again just talking to you about it. And I remember in a lot of my classes being terribly excited about what was going on. You were talking to me before we started recording about difficulties you're having now at Richmond with the anti-intellectualism of a lot of the students. What do you think that stems from?
I think in many ways it's justified because of what's happened in education in America, as I see it, that education, a college degree, let's put it that way, a college degree has been used as a club, a middle-class club, to beat down people who don't have one. You know, you can't make a living if you don't have a college degree. You have no middle-class clout. You're unworthy to use the silver fork at the rich lady's house and that sort of thing. And a lot of the women at Richmond are from working class backgrounds, and they are doing something that our generation did not do, and they're refusing to deny their origins, their working class origins, and they're keeping in touch with them in a very heavy way. And they've helped me a great deal to get in touch with my own background, my own origins. But I think this anti-intellectualism, if we can call it that sort of generally, is a reaction against the misuse the middle class has put, words, learning, books, and so forth. They've used books and words and so forth as a weapon against people who didn't have education, instead of offering it to them in a gentle and human way. And so the reaction has been against that misuse, I think, rather than against the stuff itself, because I know that some of the women who perhaps superficially show the most anti-intellectualism are terribly bright and are very hungry for knowledge, and who would probably use it better than a lot of so-called intellectuals I know now, you know. They're cleaning their heads out in a way. And when they do go to it, it's going to be good.
Well, two of my acquaintances who are very anti-intellectual, one of them was raised in a middle-class family in a wealthy suburb in Connecticut, dropped out of high school. And the other one managed to get an advanced degree in chemistry. And they're now carrying on in this very anti-intellectual way, and even denying a lot of the stuff that, well, for instance, they're both spouting some theory about how males are genetically inferior to females, in spite of the fact that we both come from the same gene pool. And I can see that from somebody who dropped out of school, but someone who's got an advanced degree in chemistry, it's another story. I've seen a lot of that in the movement, a lot of this, you know, this astrology fad that really freaks me as somebody who was an astronomy buff for years. And the whole, let's go back to the witches and cultism and the occult. I've seen it among a lot of people who are not at all serious about studying, say, yoga or Eastern religion or so on in a serious way, but just sort of spouted all over the place without knowing very much about it, and put down all sorts of Western thinking and saying how Eastern thinking is much better without having studied it, without putting the energy into it. And it drives me absolutely up the wall. I mean, I know I'm biased, over-intellectualized and so on, and I don't know anything. I know very little about Eastern thinking. But I think I know just as little as these people who are beating me over the head with something they don't know anything about. It really bothers me to see that in the movement.
Yeah, I'm familiar with what you're talking about. Is it? I'm not trying to justify it, because I still think, maybe just speaking from my own background, that I'm the woman who was saved by education and hard work and disciplined study and all that kind of thing. But I think, again, maybe what these women are doing are overreacting or reacting to the male system of study. They're trying to find a female way to learn something, and maybe it's based too much on intuition and feeling and grasping the universe through your guts or through your clitoris or something like that. But I think that eventually that maybe some good will come out of it, and it will modify
the sort of scientific approach to knowledge that we both know is not the whole thing.
This has been Lesbian Nation. Good night. See you next week. And don't forget, there's a dance tonight at the GAA Firehouse for women only. It's a pre-Halloween dance, so bring your broomstick.